Well, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for joining me. It's time for our weekly appointment with The Vatican Centuries, a series written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. While last week we took a look at the latter half of the 16th century, packed with men and women of courage and vision, of flamboyant personalities, of martyrs and poets and adventurers on the high seas, this week, in episode 36, we turn the page, only to discover the Vatican Library being rebuilt by Sixtus V, the obelisk being moved to the centre of St. Peter's Square, and, of course, the end of an enterprise, as St. Peter's Basilica is finally consecrated by Pope Urban VIII.
A colourful epoch was passing away. One by one, the legendary figures disappeared, taking with them something of the epic quality they had brought into everyday life.
Men of vision were still exploring the universe. As Galileo gazed in delight at the wonders of the skies, William Barents, in an open boat, was sailing the seas in search of a northeast passage.
On the international scene, the year 1600 showed Holland in the ascendant in commerce and culture, France gaining in military strength, Spanish sea power declining, and England suffering an economic recession.
Music and drama flourished. In London, people were flocking to the plays of Will Shakespeare.
Religion was still a source of contention. At the turn of the century, Giordano Bruno went unrepentantly to his death, the last great heretic to be burnt at the stake in the medieval manner.
2 years earlier, Philip of Spain, the austere despot of 27 kingdoms, had died. One lonely sovereign lingered on, his cousin Elizabeth.
Elizabeth Tudor did not begin her reign by persecuting Catholics. A lover of the middle way, she styled herself Supreme Governor instead of Head of the Church. She wanted the religious question settled, chiefly for the sake of political unity. She was not a militant Protestant, but sought rather to restore Catholicism without the Pope and a workable compromise in doctrine.
She failed, for she could not turn back the clock, and the glorious Elizabethan age was stained with the blood of countless English men and women, among them the gentle poet Robert Southwell and the brilliant Jesuit Edmund Campion.
Elizabeth was not entirely without a religious sense. She once declared that there is only one Christ Jesus and one faith. The rest is dispute about trifles.
Appreciation of this extraordinary woman came from an unexpected quarter.
She is a great woman. Were she only a Catholic, she would be without her match. Look how well she governs. She is only a woman, only mistress of half an island, and yet she makes herself feared by Spain, France, the Emperor, by all.
This magnificent compliment was paid to Elizabeth I by Pope Sixtus V.
The bull excommunicating Queen Elizabeth had disastrous effects and later was much regretted. It caused anguish to faithful Catholics and antagonized the English government, which responded in 1585 with the act against Jesuits and seminarists.
Whereas divers persons called or professed Jesuits, seminary priests and other priests have of late years come and been sent into this realm of England of purpose to stir up and move sedition, rebellion and open hostility to the utter ruin, desolation, and overthrow of the whole realm. For reformation whereof, be it ordained, established, and enacted, that all and every Jesuits, seminary priests, and other priests whatsoever, made or ordained out of the realm of England, by any authority, power, or jurisdiction derived, challenged, or pretended from the See of Rome, shall within 40 days next depart out of this realm of England, if the wind, weather, and passage shall serve for the same.
In 1593, the government made life for English Catholics even more difficult with the promulgation of the Act Against Recusants. This was the culmination of the anti-Roman legislation.
For the better discovering and avoiding of all such traitorous and most dangerous conspiracies as are daily devised and practiced against our most gracious Sovereign Lady, the Queen's Majesty, by sundry wicked and seditious persons, who, terming themselves Catholics, and being indeed spies and intelligences, and hiding their most detestable and devilish purposes under a false pretext of religion and conscience, do secretly wander and shift from place to place within this realm, to corrupt and seduce Her Majesty's subjects and to stir them to sedition and rebellion. Be it ordained and enacted by our Sovereign Lady the Queen's Majesty that every person above the age of 16 years, being a Popish recusant, convicted for not repairing to some church, chapel, or usual place of common prayer to hear divine service there, but forbearing the same, shall within 40 days next repair to their place of dwelling where they usually heretofore made their common abode, and shall not any time after pass or remove above 5 miles from thence.
After the death of Michelangelo, the pace of building the new Basilica of St. Peter's slackened perceptibly.
The chief architect of the time, Piero Ligorio, wanted to abandon the old master's project and was dismissed, to be succeeded by Vignola. But progress was slow. It was only when Sixtus V came on the scene that things really began to move.
Although he only reigned 5 years, Pope Sixtus V filled them with activity. He built roads, bridges, aqueducts. He raised 4 obelisks, of which the most famous is that in St. Peter's Square, because of the trouble it caused.
The first obelisk to be raised in modern times was over 77 feet high and weighed 350 tons. To move it from where it stood on the sacristy side of the church, a massive scaffolding of windlasses and pulleys was erected. It took 4 months for 900 men and 140 horses to do the job. They began on the 7th of May, 1586. In charge was the architect Domenico Fontana. In view of the risks involved, Fontana had the Pope close off the square and issue an order for absolute silence to be observed during the operations, under pain of death. The architect's notes are explicit.
Whoever crosses the boundary line will be punished by death. The same for anybody who makes a noise, or even spits, because every distraction from the work at hand and the orders given threatens great danger.
Fontana stood at the top of a high scaffolding, issuing his orders by blasts from trumpets, waving of flags, sounding of bells and beating of drums.
By the evening of the first day, the obelisk had been lifted 18 inches. Next day it was lowered and gradually transported to the new site. On September the 10th, the final phase began. A series of 52 carefully planned manoeuvres were to bring the stone into the perpendicular position and set it on its foundation.
But the historic engineering feat nearly ended in tragedy. The ropes began to give way. Suddenly a shout rang out, "Water on the ropes!" A Genoese sailor named Bresca, who was in the work team, had seen the danger. His advice came only just in time, and the ropes tautened and shrank. Instead of losing his head, Bresca received an unusual reward. He and his heirs, henceforth, were to supply the Vatican with palm fronds for use in St. Peter's on Palm Sunday.
Pope Sixtus knew his time was running out, and he was determined that the dome of St. Peter's should be set in place before he died. "Just now, it looks like a body without a head," he remarked.
Work began on the 15th of July, 1588, and went on day and night to the delight of the candlemakers. In 2 years, the dome was in place. In 1603, the partition wall across the basilica was at last removed, and the western side of the new church revealed in all its splendour.
This was a period of calm, diligent, orderly, without genius.
St. Peter's, it is said, has never really been finished. But the basilica we know today is more or less the same as the one which on November the 18th, 1626, was consecrated by Pope Urban VIII. It had cost some £10 million and had taken just over a century to build.
And you were listening there to episode 36 of The Vatican Centuries, a series written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.